The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think there were things during the Mueller investigation that he did well, you know, coming out and, you know, obviously he became a fierce, the president became a critic of Rosenstein's because of certain actions. But the one theme that I've seen and I've heard in talking with former colleagues is whenever Rosenstein did speak up, and Jeff Sessions for that matter, it wasn't because the agency had taken some hit or the institution. It was because personally they had been attacked, which that's not leadership in my view. You know, you have to be willing, to lose your job, to do your job. And if you allow these attacks on the agency to continue, if you allow this to bake into the national psyche that these organizations are corrupt, and you sit in a position where you can actually step up and say, this is wrong, or Mr. President, you know, the White House, you are wrong and you need to stop. If you fail to do that, that's not leadership.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 21st, 2019. Josh Campbell spent 12 years in the FBI, including work as a supervisory special agent and as special assistant to FBI Director James Comey. He is now a CNN law enforcement analyst and the author of Crossfire Hurricane, Inside Donald Trump's War on the FBI. I sat down recently with Josh to discuss the mission of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, his career there, what he calls President Trump's war on the FBI, and a unique perspective on the night of Director Comey's firing. Full disclosure, three of us at Lawfare, Benjamin Wittes, Susan Hennessy, and I, were interviewed by Josh for his book, but our interview today does not touch on any of that. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 454, Josh Campbell on Crossfire Hurricane. So Josh, how did you start at the FBI and why?
So my FBI career began in earnest in September 2001. I was just over a week into my college career as a freshman when the 9/11 attacks happened. And up to that point, I had thought that I was going to go into the Foreign Service. That was the way my career was, the trajectory it was on. I was interested in international relations, and so that was going to be the focus. But what was really interesting about that moment, obviously 9/11, obviously terrible for the country. But the one thing that I kept focusing on in the aftermath, both on that day, and I can remember this, but then in the days after, were the first responders and you know, the people who are now charged with trying to figure out what just happened. Those of us who were interested in international relations knew, you know, this group Al-Qaeda and international terrorism, but there was still the nuts and bolts of the investigation, really nailing down what happened, who were the hijackers, all of that. And so, you know, all the diplomacy was the goal going into college. I didn't feel very diplomatic at that moment, right, as, you know, many of us didn't. So I started researching the FBI and started actually orienting my career, my college career experience around that with the goal of one day joining the Bureau.
In terms of criminal justice classes, things like that?
Mainly national security. So looking at national security courses, coursework, really seeking out some of the professors there who were experienced in that area. And then my junior year of college, I did an internship at the FBI. Each of its 56 field offices at that time, they were able to send one intern to Washington, D.C., to FBI headquarters. And so the division I was in Texas, I was selected for that division, came to Washington, D.C., the J. Edgar Hoover building, and I did an internship. And that was really my intro to the FBI. And as you know, and as a lot of our listeners know, that the beauty of an internship is that you get to test out an agency and they get to test you out as well.
Right.
And at the end, it was just such a rich and rewarding experience that went back, graduated, and then started immediately after my senior year.
You're somewhat unusual in that in the book, you describe that you actually like the Hoover Building.
I do. I do.
And you're in the minority there.
I am.
You know that.
Absolutely. On many things, for that matter.
So your experience going in as an intern in this big bureaucracy that, let's be honest, is not always friendly to interns and others who have not progressed through the system, in the building that is, to put it mildly, outdated, you still said, oh yeah, I want to work here.
I do.
What stuck with you? What did you see and feel around you?
You know, it's interesting. You have this perception going in of an agency like the FBI, and much of the public, I'm sure they have this this view of what it is and what it might be. A lot of it's the myth, right? Which, you know, even when I was in the FBI, people would kind of joke, you know, keep the myth going, that, you know, this all-seeing, all-knowing agency. But actually being there in this internship, and the beauty of being an intern is that you have no real responsibility, right? You can make mistakes. You can kind of go out of your way to get to know people. But just meeting the people that were there. And in fact, I got to work with the team that had worked the 9/11 investigation. So even though this was 2004, you know, 3 years removed, it was still very much going on, this investigation. And it was that summer, actually, that the 9/11 Commission was up in earnest, and our FBI people were there testifying. And just being around those people and just seeing them dedicated to this mission, you know, I'd worked at different places. And, you know, if you're at a company, you know, obviously people, you find great people everywhere. But seeing people get up every single day motivated by a mission and realizing that that's not a talking point. Like, that's real. You get to see it. You experience it. That's something that I wanted to be part of. It was incredible. And even though it's in this brutalist, you know, ugly structure there on Pennsylvania Avenue, that was my entry in the FBI. And
sure.
That's how it all started.
Well, your love of the FBI and your love of the mission certainly comes through in your writings and in your reporting. Of course, at a certain point, it's not an amorphous mission. It actually becomes people. That is, the FBI does not exist as such. It is an organization of people. And among the people that you met very early when you were fresh out of college, compiling open source reporting on FBI operations for early morning briefings, was a man named Robert Swan Mueller III.
That's right.
Describe your first experience with him and how it went.
So I can remember my actual first experience was when I was an intern. I was actually at an event. It was here in D.C. where he was going to speak. It was kind of a foreign policy audience. And I remember one of my good friends, an intern who was there with me at that point, was fluent in Arabic. He was in law school at the time, so he was, you know, farther along his college career than I was. And we were just struck up a conversation with Mueller's security detail. And they started getting to know us. And one of them learned that this guy spoke Arabic. You know, he was on the cusp of having a law degree. And so this bodyguard grabs the intern, takes him over to Robert Mueller, and I'm just kind of in tow, and says, "Boss, here's a guy who wants to come to the FBI." And Mueller said, "Let's do it. Let's bring this guy on board." And so that was my actually first experience in seeing him just reach directly, you know, into the lowest level of the agency, an intern. And so you have the skill sets that we need. And so then fast forward, when I was actually brought on board, you know, full time, I would see him most mornings. He had the typical, you know, battle rhythm. He would arrive at 6:32 a.m., you know, ready to go to work. And, you know, at that point when I was there, this is now 2005, we're still in the post 9/11 era. When we think about the post 9/11 era, the daily threats, and you know this, you know, better than most, that he was keeping track of. It was just an incredible rhythm from morning to night, you know, trying to counter all these threats that are still manifesting some years later. And so fresh out of college, my initial role, entry level there in public affairs, was to gather these kind of open source material that can then augment his kind of classified briefing of the world to give them this picture of what is going on in the world.
And this is open source reporting, what the press is saying about the FBI and its operations worldwide?
Correct, both. So both about the FBI, just from a corporate standpoint, you want to know what's being said about you. But also, you know, as you know, there are many journalists who are often ahead of investigators, ahead of the intelligence community. And so if there was any type of threat, anything that was of interest that could then drive, at least inform his view of how investigations are being worked, he wanted to know all of that, you know, soak all of that up. And so that was the experience. It's just, you know, as a very junior person,
right,
you know, in the morning getting to see the boss, and, you know, at least I felt at that point some small way helped contribute to his ability to run the organization, very small way, I should say. But no, that was my intro to him as a leader.
So describe how that went that first time. You hand him the essentially a compilation of these various reports, and perhaps not knowing it, if I would have known you were coming, I probably would have briefed you in advance about what Director Mueller expected from a briefer.
Exactly.
But you hand him this document, and what, he asked you what was in it?
Yeah, it was interesting because I thought, this was probably a couple months in now, in doing this job. And this particular day, I was running late, and I didn't really have time to digest what was in this document. And I write about this in the book because this really helped inform my view of him as a leader. So, I'm walking into his office, and you go through this kind of corridor and down the long conference room, and he's sitting there with all these stacks of wiretap authorizations, on his desk. And that was his what he was doing at the time. And so I hand him the news briefing, and he asked, he said, "Well, what's in it?" And I said, "It's news." And I thought, no, that's kind of like a wise-ass response, to tell this guy.
It can come across that way.
Yeah, and I think it did. So I still, vividly remember him looking at me, and he, says something like, "not helpful." And he snatches it, and he starts reading, and that was my signal to then depart. But then the next day, as I mentioned, he gave me a mulligan. So I came back in ready to brief. I got there, even an hour before the normal time. And I walk up, and he says, kind of with a half smile, which, obviously not one known to smile, but he says, "Okay, let's try this again."
Right.
And thankfully with a different result than the first time.
Maybe your experience was similar to mine, which is you could make mistakes with Bob Mueller. There was this reputation that you had to be perfect every time. You didn't. You could make a mistake and the next day learn from it and be better, as it sounds like you were. You couldn't make the same mistake twice, because then you would get the dreaded Mueller stare, as if, "Didn't we talk about this already?" He didn't say those words, but he clearly communicated that.
Exactly. And I saw that. Not learning from your mistake, repeating something, because there's no time for that, right? I mean, these are the agencies with these life and death missions. And so that was certainly a part of it. And the second thing, which I saw both firsthand, and then this reverberated throughout the agency, is the one thing that he also could not stand was someone who was not giving it to him straight. And so if he asked you a question and you didn't know the answer and you tried to, come up with something, on the fly, I mean, he would eat you alive. I saw it done, a number of times. So much so it was actually kind of funny later on in my FBI career when I became an agent. I was working counterterrorism investigations. I was actually set to brief him on one of the cases, and one of his staff members calls and didn't know that I had worked, back in the director's office back in the day, but actually warned me and said, "Look, if you don't know the answer, like, don't make it up." And I kind of laughed because I thought, yeah, that's the same Bob Mueller that we know.
That's good. That's the system working.
Yeah.
It's people helping each other. And it's not about avoiding the director's wrath, although personally, it might feel that way.
Right.
It's about helping a very busy person doing a very important job do it as well as possible.
Exactly.
And making sure you use his time effectively.
Exactly.
He had some other quirks. And you write in the book that many years later, when he came back to the Hoover building, when he was starting out as special counsel, he looked around and he said, "What the hell happened to this place?" Now, he wasn't referring to the architecture. He wasn't referring to personnel issues per se. What was he referring to?
So this was, again, this mythical Mueller, everyone kind of knows the man. And one thing that people knew in the agency is that he had this, I think it was unwritten, I never saw it written, but this kind of unwritten rule that he wanted people in the suits with the white shirts, the white Oxford shirts, so much so that you would look across the table to the senior executives, every morning in the meeting, and almost to a person, you would see that white Oxford buttoned up, the mythical, or the typical, I should say, FBI look. Mm-hmm. And as it's been described, it wasn't because he was some prude who just wanted everyone, but he realized that in the wake of 9/11, he was driving such intense change into this organization that he wanted to signal to the old guard that, look, we're not changing everything. The old, serious FBI agent who's there doing the job, we're not going to change that. And so as it was described, he tried to model that by making sure that his, the people around him resembled him essentially. But fast forward, as you mentioned, when he's no longer in the FBI and he comes in, this was the day that he took the baton to become the new special counsel. He comes to FBI headquarters, he's getting briefed, and a buddy of mine who's actually the head of the security detail who worked for Mueller back in the day and then for Comey, we're walking him out, we're in the elevator, we're going down into the bowels of the J. Edgar Hoover building, we're both flanking him, and he looks to his left and he looks to his right, and he sees that we're both wearing nearly the identical same purple patterned shirt. And we knew it was coming as soon as he did his, dramatic look. And his response was, "What the hell happened to this place?" Before, he let out a loud belly laugh.
See, I could get away with that as an interloper. I was a CIA guy coming in to brief him. And sure enough, before going into that room with him, there'd be the chief of staff, the deputy, and others around. And they were all in various shades of medium gray suits, cut the same way, with starched white shirts.
Exactly.
And of course, ties. And I would come in sometimes with a different suit or with a colored shirt. And I would get some looks from others who thought, are you of the Bureau? And they would quickly realize I wasn't, right, because I wasn't behaving like they would. I was just walking straight to his office to brief.
Yeah.
Never got a word from him on it. Hmm. And I think it's because I was from outside the organization.
Right.
Maybe it was a good foil to use me as an example, point out to the interns, do you want to look like that guy? Of right. course you don't. Be a professional.
Well, in mitigation, to your credit, he may have been thinking, we need this agency, so the last right. thing I'm going to do is try to offend them.
We'll go with that.
Yeah, there yeah. you go.
Josh, you tell a story in the book about a meeting with a source, somebody who's giving information that was vital to national security. And going back to this issue of the mission and why it drew you in, you remember the source telling you why the source trusted you, why the source was giving you this information and not someone else. And the source said to you very directly, you are the FBI. Everyone knows you can trust the FBI. And yet you also cite a poll from last year that said a bare majority, only 51% of Americans expressed confidence in the FBI, which was down more than 10 points from just a few years earlier. How do you deal with that, knowing that there was this organization that people were willing to give information to, and now that may not be true as much as it was then?
No, this is the point of the book, is really to show that there are consequences to this campaign of attack that we've seen from the president, from his allies. And at the outset, I think it's important to say to someone who's now in journalism that, you know, I'm not a shill for the FBI, so I don't go out there saying that everything the FBI does is right. They're human beings. They're fallible. In the book, I write about some of their mistakes as well. And even now in journalism, you know, my job is to help the public understand when their government is not operating, you know, in the manner we expect. So I say all that at the outset to say, when it comes to the organization's reputation, it's not your typical Fortune 500 company or government agency, for that matter, that just wants to be liked. And so my contention is not that, you know, their politicians are being mean to the FBI and that's a bad thing. There are serious, real consequences to the public losing confidence in law enforcement in America. And the example that you cite is one of them. And I opened the first chapter in the book with that story of meeting with the source overseas, where, you know, my partner and I, we had traveled thousands of miles to Southeast Asia to meet with someone who had signaled through us, through some of our interlocutors, that he had information that he wanted to bring to our attention to help the U.S. government go after a high-value terrorist who had been responsible for killing a number of people in Southeast Asia, but including American citizens. And so at that point, you know, we had done a lot of work in Southeast Asia, but we travel over, you know, the planes, trains, and automobiles and helicopters and, you know, going to this very remote area to meet with this one person to gather this information. As you mentioned, I couldn't help but asking him at the end, you know, why didn't you just walk into the police station here and tell him what you knew? And he said exactly what you just said. You're the FBI. You can trust the FBI.
Do you worry that after the last couple of years that that is happening less, or people are having at least second thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, it's one of those where it's unknowable because you're proving a negative. You're proving that something didn't happen, that, you know, people didn't lose faith in an institution. But at least anecdotally, I know that, you know, I talk to agents that work in the field. And in addition to morale, you know, taking a hit internally, there are some signals out there that this campaign of attack is hurting their operations. So I talked to one agent, for example, who works counterintelligence investigations, and he explained one example of how this is impacting their operations. He told me that in the wake of this effort by Congressman Devin Nunes, who was then the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who was engaged in this effort to try to identify whether the FBI had you know, put a what they call a spy into the Trump campaign, what people in the business would call an informant, you know, a confidential human source. And that effort that was underway that eventually led to this person's name being outed, someone who had, you know, reportedly helped the U.S. government, really reverberated around not only, you know, Washington, but around the country. And this one agent told me, he works counterintelligence cases, that one of his own agents signaled that he wanted to meet with him. And during this meeting, the source tells the FBI agent, I want you to promise me that my name will never get out there. And this agent was recounting this story to me. I mean, it's very, very dramatic fashion. He said that he realized at that point that he could not promise that to this mm-hmm. person, because we're in this new, you know, uncharted territory. where you have politicians that are interfering in the work of the FBI in a way that we've never seen. Now, obviously, Congress has a very important oversight role, and that, you know, cannot be changed.
But traditionally, the oversight role has not included outing the names of sources for politically inconvenient investigations.
Exactly, right. And building this narrative that these people are corrupt and, you know, there's this criminal cabal, the deep state, so to speak. And so he told me, he said, you know, I told the source, I can't make you that promise. And so that's one example. You know, how many others out there are like it, we don't know. But the one thing that also concerns me is, you know, and I've run a number of sources around the world, and that's a key part of investigations, the key part of collecting intelligence is going places you can't go. And that involves having another person willing to do that work for you. And so I wonder how many people around the world who maybe thought about coming to the FBI or even the CIA or, you know, another agency are now stopping to think, well, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to be that person. That's a real world consequence that impacts public safety. So when the president and his allies say there's this deep state, there's this corruption going on, that may be a political talking point as far as a campaign to manipulate the public into believing a certain narrative, but it has real consequences as it relates to life and death.
And ones that will linger. Because that source may not come in and help an investigation that would matter to those people years down the road.
Yeah.
Because developing sources often doesn't happen overnight.
And public sentiment is generational, right? I mean, you know, this isn't flipping a switch. We saw, and I talk about in the book as well, the real intelligence abuses of the U.S. government under the era of J. Edgar Hoover and, you know, getting into the Church Committee and the like. Real abuses of power, violations of civil liberties that were remedied by new laws, oversight, limiting the FBI director to a single 10-year term, those kind of things. And in the wake of that, it's taken decades for the public to now trust these agencies that we will afford you this latitude to do what you have to do because we don't think you're the same agency that was described back in the 70s.
Right.
This is what the president and his allies are trying to describe today, that these agencies are just as abusive as they were then. And so my fear is that, you know, as you mentioned, not only is this not going to be a, you know, a day or a year-long story as it relates to sources, but the confidence of the American people and the public, that may take a generation to change.
And some of that has to do with confidence in leadership too. And in the book, you talk about several directors. I think you may obliquely mention J. Edgar Hoover and Louis Freeh, but the three directors you address directly are Robert Mueller, James Comey, and Christopher Wray. We can get back to Director Wray later if we have time, but you spend the most time talking about Jim Comey. Mm-hmm. Describe what you saw and what impression you got about Jim Comey as a leader, as an effective leader of an organization of people.
What interests me most now looking at the way his critics describe him, Jim Comey, as this sanctimonious, you know, pious. Someone who's self-certain. Mm-hmm. That narrative is so interesting because, and again, you know, good people may believe that. That's up to them. But that doesn't square with the Jim Comey that I knew and, you know, the folks on our staff that they saw every single day because, you know, I'll just give you one example. I mean, I got my job in part because I had this chance encounter with Jim Comey where he asked me for feedback on something. And I was very critical of him and, you know, the state of the organization.
Which we should point out, in any government bureaucracy, that is not the norm.
Right.
The easiest thing to do is to say at least something neutral, but often something positive, even if you don't feel that way when a leader asks you directly.
Exactly.
But you gave him something straight.
Something straight. The way I calculated it was, so I was actually finishing my headquarters tour. Mm-hmm. I was going back to the field, and I thought, what are they going to do?
You're being sent out anyway.
Yeah, exactly. This is my last week. But then also I thought, you know, when am I going to have this audience with, you know, the CEO of the agency? And so I gave him really critical advice or feedback. And then that led to a job, him actually bringing me onto his staff. And he told me afterwards, he said, whenever I got the call, he said, why don't you come help me fix all that stuff you said was screwed up?
Yep.
That was Jim Comey. That was the nature of him as a leader, is he wanted critical feedback. He was afraid he would get trapped in this bubble where, you know, he would start hearing ideas parroted back to him and say, well, that's a great idea. But it turned out it was something that he had said in a meeting that other people, you know, just wanting the boss to believe that they agree with what he says. So he would try to break out of that to the extent he could. And one way to do that was to have people who would give you honest, critical feedback. And in fact, the only time that I saw him really angry, one of the two times, one was described in the book when he's on the phone with the White House and they're trying to, you know, they want the FBI to basically jump in front of a New York Times story, which that angered him. But the only other time that I saw him angry was when we were in a meeting and someone was telling him something that he knew was untrue about his own performance as director. And he just blasted this person. And I mean, it was in Congress because that wasn't the normal Jim Comey. But, you know, his point was, look, we don't pay you to tell me that everything's great. Like, I need to know, you know, what's the truth is. And so that kind of leadership is, I think, rare, you know, especially in this town. And one thing about him also, which I think is interesting, that I've never seen before in any leader, and I read a lot about leadership and a lot about how these senior executives operate, and I haven't seen the same type of what I kind of describe as this maniacal focus on leadership. That his day was spent trying to figure out how can I best lead this organization. He was the CEO, so he looked to Andrew McCabe, his number two, the deputy, as the chief operations officer. Right, he would run the day-to-day investigations, and he'd come to the boss to make the hard calls. But his goal was really to corporately run this organization to improve the leadership in his office. And I don't know if he's ever talked about this, but on his office wall, he had little 2-inch by 2-inch magnets of every senior executive service leader in the organization. So I think some 200 plus people. He had their little picture on a magnet, and he would constantly stare at that, thinking he had a 10-year term, you know, ahead of him, thinking, okay, these are the people that embody these types of qualities I'm looking for. What direction do I see them going? And it was almost like this kind of matrix-like, you know, staring at a board and trying to figure out, okay, what looking into the future. Minority Report, that's a movie I was trying to think of. I flubbed the reference here. But, you know, trying to look in the future, and I've never seen that type of leadership in someone. And so when he left, that was one theme that I constantly heard from colleagues is, will this kind of maniacal leadership continue because it's really benefited this agency?
Not everyone in the organization gets to spend that much time in the director's office to even see that there's a board where he's thinking about the leadership of the future, not for the next 6 months, but perhaps for the next 6 years.
Exactly.
But yet the effects are felt in an organization. How did that happen? How do you think the rank and file, of which you were a part, and you would go out to the field, talk to people. You would talk to people within the building that weren't accessing the director's suite every day. What sense did you get from them about how this was resonating?
Two different ways in particular, and they're both a little bit of the opposite. But the first is that if people in the field, in some field office in Los Angeles or Seattle or, you know, Omaha, if they could do their job every single day without worrying about the FBI director, good to go.
Yeah.
Not some edict coming down from on high that we're changing this or we're doing that. Just let you do your job. That was a theme that we often heard.
So is it safe to say that even good leadership, if it's coming from the Hoover building, it will almost always have a negative start out in the field?
That's right. Yeah. So kind of the no news is good news. Yeah. You know, if we're status quo, good to go. If there's some mistake that corporately we need to change, then you start seeing that. Now, he would reach out regularly. He would email the whole workforce all the time. And he would write his emails. He would respond to emails from employees. That was his, again, way of kind of breaking out of this bubble. But for the most part, if you didn't hear from headquarters, then, you know, again, let you do your job. So that was good. But the second thing, which resonated as well, which people felt as a framework for just how the organization promotes people, is he kind of changed this culture where before, you know, if you were a bully in the FBI, your ability to promote, you know, and I don't know what numbers wise, but you would see a lot of people that would be considered bullies in these high powered positions. The thinking being, if you can break some china and just go in and you were, you know, aggressive, then you can lead people, which as we know is obviously not the case. So he changed that 180 degrees. And so that touched every person in the agency who decided that they wanted to go into leadership, because the whole framework of how you become a leader then changed. Again, you know, he would say that he looks for these two competing qualities, people who are kind but tough. So not one or the other, you know, who are kind enough to be tough to, you know, give you honest assessments, but also people who are confident enough to be humble, that didn't have to tell you their life story or give you their resume before they, you know, start a sentence. And so those qualities trickled down to the field in a way, again, that I think benefited the organization. And I think the last thing on that that's important to note is I know that there's a danger in me, someone who was close to him, saying, oh, all these great things, you know, these great things that he did. But I'll give you some hard data. I mean, in the organization, every year, FBI employees fill out anonymous surveys about leadership. And this helps, you know, leaders get an unvarnished view of how your own people see you without, you know, the fear of retribution.
This is like an upward feedback process.
Upward feedback, yeah. People would go online. It was, you know, mandatory. I don't know if everyone did it. But actually, after he was fired, And you had Sarah Sanders at the White House and others saying, you know, Comey was a terrible leader. We got rid of him. I think it was the New York Times. And I think you're calling Ben Wittes here and FOIA'd a lot of this survey data, which actually showed that Comey had high marks throughout the organization, that people valued his leadership. So, again, I only mention that because that's a data set that's not just me sitting here saying, you know, oh, he was a great guy. Right. But people actually believed it.
So both from the data point of view there and from the anecdotal experiences you had, it's safe to say that when the White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Sanders spoke publicly about the loss of faith that had come in Comey and that countless members of the FBI had reached out to be grateful for Trump firing him, that doesn't match with your experience.
It doesn't match with my experience. And by the way, she admitted that that was not true later on. Once she was questioned by Robert Mueller under penalty of perjury, she explained that all that was nonsense, that there weren't countless members of the FBI reaching out. And what's so interesting, and I've gone back and looked at this just in journalism, is I've watched that exchange with her probably a dozen times. And the media that were in the audience, they asked her, you know, how do you know that the FBI has no confidence in Comey? And she said, well, countless have reached out to me. And there's this pause. And one reporter says, really? Like, they're calling you? And she says, well, calls, text messages, emails, I mean, really starts digging in on this lie. Which, again, if it's not true, just the whole, you know, making out of a whole cloth of, you know, thin air, then you're lying,
right? At least there was an opportunity to stop at the point when you're questioned and you say, oh, I misspoke.
Correct.
I mean, in theory, to give her credit, she wasn't wrong at the beginning. It was countless because there may have been none to count.
That's right. Fair point. That's right. And maybe no emails or text messages. But it, again, you know, it just shows. And this was what really interesting because in that moment inside the FBI, I remember this, you know, at least the team that I was on when we were watching a report of her press conference and people were just, you know, yelling at the television, probably in ways that are not appropriate for this podcast, but expressing their, you know, disagreement with her assessment. But then later on, and I, you know, talk to people in the FBI all the time, that was one point that they took away from the Mueller report that they quietly celebrated was her actually, you know, at least it coming to light that that was nonsense. It was a lie.
And you've said before, and I think in your book you note this, very, very often you have no idea the partisan leanings of the people you work with. It's just not something that comes up all the time. It's about the mission. It's about the job. There were a few times when you mentioned, yeah, I did know that the person I was talking to was a hardcore Republican. Mm-hmm. You note that because sometimes those are the people who have said, oh, this is a bridge too far. You know, even they didn't say the thing in between. But even if I support policies politically as a citizen of this country that are coming out of this administration, what that person just said from the White House podium is repugnant. And that's when you noted the only notes you had of any partisan feeling at the Bureau were going that direction. You didn't get the sense of it going the other way.
No, because I think the other was a given. So if I knew someone was, you know, on the left or progressive, then I didn't really give it as much credibility because just in these assessments, because it's, okay, well, is this person criticizing the action or are they just ideologically opposed to the person in power? But what was fascinating was seeing people who were ideologically in line with the president, seemingly more angry than the others because of this quote unquote, you know, party of law enforcement that the Republican Party, you know, has. Obviously, the FBI, at least I contend, is, you know, a right leaning organization. One thing that's really fascinating too for the listeners is that, you know, you always hear this thing, and I think I've been guilty of this before, saying that, you know, everyone in the FBI checks their politics at the door. Like, you never discuss it. That's not true. It's a workplace. It's like any other, you know, organization where, you know, some people you may not know, they just decide I'm not going to talk about politics at all. But, you know, we're not robots. We don't just sit there, you know, pouring through information and conducting investigations. They're people. And so you would seemingly know, you know, where
one
person—
A few of them at least.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe not all.
Certainly not all. Right. But, you know, you would know from some. But it's not as though that would impact their work. I mean, it was just a cultural— it wasn't even a question that whether someone was Republican or Democrat or you know, no party, that was then going to drive the way that they conducted a particular investigation. It's just not the way it works.
That seems shocking in these times. But yet that's similar to my experience and that of many others is— You know, going back now 20 years of people I knew when I was working at CIA and since, for more of them than not, I can tell you how they feel about the Washington Redskins. I can tell you how they feel about certain pop artists or other sporting figures or teams more than I can tell you their political leanings. It's not that I don't know any of their political leanings, but there are still some people I worked with, people I keep in touch with. I have no idea where they are politically because that's just not the most important thing that we ever talk about, even when we're moving away from work to other topics.
Exactly.
So you paint a good picture in the book overall, and you've spoken here well about Jim Comey as a leader and as someone interacting with people. But he does not come off blameless in your book either.
Correct.
You cite a couple of times when you think things could have been done better. Let me hit you with one. When Director Comey spoke out publicly about the investigation into then-candidate Secretary Hillary Clinton, recommending no prosecution, but giving some pretty harsh language about her use of private server and her handling of classified material, using the phrase extremely careless, which made headlines, of course, for weeks. You write that in hindsight, this was an avoidable error. How so?
So if you go back and look at what Jim Comey did on that day, so, you know, stepping outside the leadership of the Justice Department to make this announcement, which was obviously seen around the world, I understand why he did what he did, and he said it, you know, at length.
And let's be clear about that. The Attorney General had not recused.
Correct.
Even though there was the perception, and perhaps just a perception, that because of going onto an airplane and talking with Bill Clinton, this changed things in terms of how it would be looked upon by the public. But she did not recuse herself from decision-making at that point, which then affected Director Comey's decision-making.
Exactly. No, you're spot on. And it's and perception is so important, because if you drop the names, basically you had remove the names. You had the nation's chief law enforcement officer meeting with the spouse of the highest profile subject under criminal investigation inside the FBI privately. So remove the name.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good, does it?
It doesn't sound good.
No.
And so even from a matter of perception, what Jim Comey thought was, look, because Loretta Lynch, who I'm a big fan of, actually, mm-hmm. I think she's a really good leader and a really good person. I saw her interact with FBI employees that in a way that the public wouldn't see, and just a warm, really good person. Sally Yates, for that matter, same way. Mm-hmm. But that said, perception is sometimes reality, or can appear to be reality. So what Comey thought was, because she's not recusing herself, because she's still in the chain of command of this investigation, if we do the normal thing, quote unquote, where we just send them a letter saying we think you shouldn't prosecute, and they issue a one-line statement, nothing to see here, folks, then the FBI would be seen as possibly in the tank with the Clintons. And that's one criticism that Comey gets a lot, is that maybe he's too focused on perception. But that was his thinking at the time. That said, where I kind of part ways with his view, and I write about in the book, is I get the point where you want to describe the actions of the investigation. You want the American people to know what you did, that you did a thorough job, that this wasn't just a quick, okay, we're letting her off the hook here. But when he gets into really characterizing her behavior, that's the fault, I think. And by the way, I think he's, he said since that he probably would have done it differently, at least mm-hmm. the language that he chose. So that's one instance.
So maybe just dialing it back, not going up to 11, but pulling it back just a bit.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's interesting because I try to, I try to orbit this and put myself in the shoes of different people. And in the book, I actually I sat down to have lunch with her former campaign manager, yep. Robbie Mook. And so here I am, the person working for Comey. He's working for Clinton. And so I was just fascinated. What was it like to experience all of this? And, he was telling me that from their standpoint, which I didn't fully appreciate, is that they didn't know anything that was going on with the investigation, but they were constantly being asked to comment on things that were leaking out. Mm. And so then when they hear that there's this press conference, and as he mentions it, he says, well, what do you do? Like, the director's just gone on TV and says she didn't do anything wrong, but she's a terrible person. Like, that's not the way it should work. So that's one fault. And I don't know if you want to talk about more.
We can,
just,
but let's finish up on that one. Does Robbie Mook have a point there about leaking, presumably, largely, if not fully, from the FBI? There's this myth that the FBI never leaks. Of course, history shows it does. J. Edgar Hoover famously said, never embarrass the FBI. Mm-hmm. And the idea there would be, don't leak, don't expose us to that. But sometimes the leaks were so as not to embarrass the FBI, to show the American people, no, we're doing our job, and we're going to let you know exactly how in a way that won't be shown publicly otherwise. But did he have a point that there was too much leaking going on in this time frame?
I think the untold story of the Clinton investigation, and it seems like the 2016 election will never go away, but I think the untold story is not people inside the FBI who were allegedly out to get Donald Trump. I mean, I think that's nonsense. People, obviously, when I talk about the book, people who made gigantic mistakes in expressing their views.
But in this case, we're talking largely about leaks that were to show Hillary Clinton was under investigation.
And
it was people leaking against the other candidate.
That is the untold story, I think, what happened there. Because if anything, this idea that the FBI is partisan and political, folks on the right don't want to talk about that aspect, that there may be people on the inside that were leaking information to hurt Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And one thing that was interesting, I think Comey has mentioned this publicly, is that he ordered a leak investigation into trying to, you know, figure out, are there people here that are leaking information? And again, it doesn't matter what your partisan view is. You don't leak information about an investigation. And so, you know, you're talking with Robbie and you know, and others kind of on the left, that's one thing obviously that incensed him to this day, is that there's been no accountability. How did information about the case get out? Obviously, it's not going to come from her team. So it has to come from somewhere. And by the way, a lot of it was accurate. So, you know, square that
right.
circle.
Yeah. Right. The other one that now we'll get back to is after Director Comey left, he decided to share his contemporaneous memos of conversations with the president publicly, but via a cutout. And you say that was an avoidable mistake. Why?
Yeah, I think that was a mistake because, well, for two reasons. First, his goal was transparency, but he didn't operate transparently. Mm. And, you know, again, you kind of go back to that place in time. His view, as he's described it, is when the president was essentially threatening him, you know, you better hope there aren't tapes out there. Comey thought, wow, there might be tapes out there. And so I'm trying to spur, you know, get this special counsel appointed who would then be able to look into this.
Sure.
At that point, because of Rod Rosenstein's actions and his mm-hmm. questionable activity, there was this question with, mm-hmm. you know, as far as whether the Justice Department itself was operating independently. And so what Comey decided was he was going to take at least some of these memos that he had memorialized regarding his interactions with Trump and get that to the media. And so he had a friend, you know, mm-hmm. obviously read it to the New York Times. We know that story. I think that was avoidable because if the goal was transparency, and I've since told him this, and you know, mm-hmm. we've had it was almost reminiscent of my time on his staff. You know, we've had these heated kind of conversations since. We've gone back and forth. Where my view is that he should have held a press conference.
He should have walked out with the memos in hand, saying, "These are my memos. I am speaking out."
Right, about and if not, you know, divulge them. At least say, you know, say, "Look, I memorialized my interactions with the president." Those are within the custody of the Justice Department. Congress, have at it. Because at that point, the public didn't know that they existed. There were only a small handful of us that, you know, in the organization that knew about that. So I think that would have been a way because – and I say avoidable because then that opens the gate to, you know, people calling him a leaker and the like. And even then, even if he didn't go to the press, I think, you know, to Congress or the courts, you know, would have been an appropriate venue. That said, as I mentioned, you know, in the book, I don't know if I was in the minority, but I wasn't. This wasn't a universal theme. There were a lot of people in the Bureau that were happy that the American people were finally learning the truth that the president had tried to obstruct an investigation and that the president had demanded loyalty from an FBI director. And if the vehicle for getting that information out was Comey recounting a private discussion between him and another person who just so happened to be the president, then so be it. So that's kind of the rub there.
Yeah. Let me go to one of the episodes in your book and perhaps the one where you have the most value to add to our understanding of events, which is what happened on Tuesday, May 9th, 2017, specifically once the director and you were both in Westwood, you know, speaking with field office employees. Walk us through that evening and how it was that the director found out that he was now unemployed.
So this day, May 9th, started just like any other day on the FBI director in the director's office. He was set to visit the field. He was constantly on the road because, as he would say, the FBI is a deployed force, 56 field offices around the country, 400 satellite offices. I want to get out. I want to see the troops. And so he was constantly on the go. And so this particular day, we were scheduled to fly from Washington, drop down to Florida, where he was going to meet with folks and then fly out to L.A. So we get to Los Angeles. He was there at a diversity recruitment event that this was this idea inside the Bureau that because the Bureau had not been recruiting the number of people of color that it wanted to, mm-hmm. he wanted to personally go out and talk to audiences of qualified, you know, graduate students and the like, minorities, to try to recruit them himself, to explain to them why they should join the FBI. And so this was one of those events that was set in Los Angeles. Because we had gotten there early, he asked if he can go to the field office and, you know, meet the troops. Mm-hmm. So we drove to Westwood, to the field office there, which was interesting for me because this was my old field office. So it was weird kind of bringing him to my old colleagues. Hey, look what I brought. But it was great. And he made the rounds, you know, meeting the troops and talking with people. He would stop at their cubicle and get little updates on kind of what they were doing. Some of them had pictures of him already like in their cubicle from previous visits, which was kind of funny because, again, he was constantly on the go. But as he was in the operations center there on the 14th floor, he's addressing a group of employees who were gathered.
And up to that point, if I can pause you there.
Sure.
Up to that point in the interactions, in the elevator coming up, in the office walking through, you know, he's not somebody who's going to get led to the room and then formally begin a conversation. He's going to chat with people on the way. Was there any sense of anger at the director or dissatisfaction about this? The kind of stuff that we said that Sarah Sanders referred to about the FBI up in arms against the director and livid at him. Did you get any sense of that from the people, without naming anybody, from the people in that building?
Not that particular day, because this wasn't a typical field office visit, like a scheduled visit. Mm-hmm. So he would do regular visits, which always included a town hall with the employees, and he would field questions. And some of them
and
would
want people to vent.
Want
That's
them
the
to
whole
vent.
Purpose.
Exactly. Right. And some people would ask pointed questions about the, you know, Hillary Clinton case in particular, because, you know, again, that was still front of mind for a lot of people.
But on this day in Westwood, when he's talking with people, it wasn't a barrage of criticisms.
No, it's him wanting to – it's basically one way him asking them about what they're doing, you know, investigations and the like. And
so sorry, you were talking about how he's standing and talking and looking around.
Yeah, so he's addressing a group and, you know, as that point, you know, being on a staff for quite some time now, I perfected this art of, you know, being on my phone, preparing for what's next and kind of listening, you know, out of one ear. And all of a sudden he goes quiet. And so I'm kind of snapped out of my reading and I look over and he's looking at me and he's nodding to the back of the room. And in the back of the room, there were two televisions and one of them turned to Fox News. The Chiron said, Comey resigns. And so I'm looking and he's looking and people are trying to figure out, well, that's weird. And he actually thought it was a joke. Like he thought that one of the tech agents had tried to mess with them.
Did he say that publicly at the time or was that in conversation with you later?
No,
that
he
revealed?
Said that's pretty funny, you know, kind of pointing at it because he was trying to process it. Presumably he would know if he resigned. So that's why none of it made
any
sense.
Think.
Right, you would think.
We live in strange times.
We do live in strange times.
So he says, wow, look at that joke.
Yeah,
right?
That's pretty funny. And people are they spin around and look. And then just a few seconds later, actually my CNN colleague Jeff Zeleny comes on the screen that was tuned to CNN. And there Chiron says Comey's been fired and he's reporting that. And, you know, you hear these gasps in the room. I mean, it was very dramatic in the sense that people are like, what just happened? You're processing this. And what was interesting for him, so he didn't want to just rush off and, you know, I mean, obviously I don't know actually what was going through his mind. If he purposefully figured out, I'm going to continue to talk to these people and finish my meeting with them. But nevertheless, as that's going on, I stepped aside and called back to Washington. And I connected with one of the senior leaders who actually hadn't heard the news. He was on his way home. And so he redirects back to headquarters. And, you know, we later learn that the president's personal bodyguard had essentially dropped off a letter at the escort desk at the Hoover building, letting the director know he was fired, not realizing it wasn't even in the same time zone. Mm. And so it was just kind of this chaotic aftermath. So we find an office that's next to this operations center. I go in there with Comey. And again, we're just trying to process what's happened because we've heard about this from the news. There's been no official formal word of any of this. And so he didn't even know if it was true. So he called his wife and I stepped out, you know, let them speak privately. And we're trying to make sense of everything that was going on. Go back into the office and, you know, we're seated there. And he's just kind of staring out the window at, you know, the Hollywood Hills, just trying to process this. And he says, you know, I remember him saying, I hope this isn't true.
So it was still surreal even then, even with time to process it. It still wasn't all adding up.
None of it made sense because, I mean, even now, like none of it made sense. You know, looking, I mean, actually, no, it made perfect sense in hindsight because we now know the real reason he was fired. But at the time, it was, you know, really trying to make sense of what was going on. And so a bit of time passes and I actually asked him, I said, look, you know, we're going to leave, obviously. And, you know, I talked to someone on the security detail and I asked him, you know, actually, you know, told him we need to get Comey home. Our plan was to overnight in Los Angeles, but my thinking was, you know, he wants to be with his family. Right. You know, we need to get home. And so there was this question about whether we could actually fly because we'd flown all day from down to Florida and
so
then
the
to
flight
LA.
Crew time becomes a real
they
issue
timed
at this
out.
Point.
Exactly. Cool. So there was all this work behind the scenes to try to figure out what, you know, what to do about that. So we're getting ready to leave to go to a different office that where he'd have a little more space and we can make phone calls. And so I asked him, I said, you know, I don't know where your head is right now. And I remember telling him, I can only imagine, but you've only hit 3 floors of this 17-floor building. If you're okay with it, we should ask if anyone wanted to see you to come down, you know, and see you. And he said, oh, I would love that. And he said, but make sure it's not an order.
Not like, to force them.
Not to force them, yeah. So I stepped out and the head of the field office was there, great leader named Deirdre Fike. And I, you know, explain to her if there are people that want to come see him, you know, so be it. And she said, okay, give me 10 minutes. So I go back in, you know, a little time passes and we'd actually gotten the official word by that point now that they had scanned the document and sent it out. And so I remember very vividly, we step out into the operations center, and I expected there'd be a few people there, but the room is just packed, wall to wall of people. And I remember it almost reminded me of like an Italian funeral, because they just erupt in applause, like as he stepped out, which was more, you know, obviously people were sad, but it was celebrating him. And funereal, I think, is the only way to describe the experience, because here he had just been, you know, terminated essentially. But, and so he addresses them, the employees, and he you know, exchanges some words and says, you know, keep doing your mission. You know, I'm going to go figure out what's going on. And what's really interesting is there's a photo from that day that one of the folks on my team had captured, where it's Comey standing there. The picture is taken from behind him, and you see this face of just stunned, like shell-shocked people. You know, that's not going to get released because some of these people work in these sensitive jobs. But that really captured the moment of this, you know, what was going on. So we go to relocate to a larger office, and he's making more phone calls back to Washington. I'm trying to figure out the flight crew thing with the security detail. And interestingly enough, we get word that the Department of Homeland Security Secretary wants to talk to Comey, John Kelly. So patch him through. And the reason why this is important, you know, at least for me, is because it really shows, as we talk about those who criticize the certain ethical lapses in the administration as it relates to the truth and being honest. I think, you know, Here's the Washington Post has said, you know, the president told like 10, 12,000 lies. This was really interesting because you had Comey talking to Kelly on the phone, and I'm seated right next to him. And rather than Kelly reassuring Comey, it was almost the other way around, where Comey is almost, you know, like a therapist telling Kelly, you know, you need to keep doing it. No, don't leave. You need to keep doing it. And the reason that's interesting, because later it came out that that call had happened, and I think Comey had talked about it, you know, said that, you know, I took this call, but the White House denied it, and John Kelly denied it. And they said, no, this was just a perfunctory, you know, good luck to you, best of luck to you.
More than that.
It was a lot more than that. I knew from my side of it that it was. So at that point, we finally figured out the logistics. The security detail had identified a crew in Denver that they were going to then swap out. So we would fly to Denver and then on to Washington. So we head to LAX. And what was interesting is we're driving down the 405. We have a police cruisers from the California Highway Patrol, you know, in front of and behind us.
For a former director.
For a former director.
Right.
Right. Exactly. But they're still, you know, they're still protecting him. And I open a news app on my phone, and I'm watching us, you know, as the news helicopters, you know, trail us to LAX, which is just so surreal.
So the first and hopefully only time you felt a little like O.J. Simpson.
That's how it's been described, is the O.J. experience. So we get to the airport, and between the time that we left the field office and we get to the airport, we determined that we didn't need to stop in Denver. The FAA had provided clearance to fly all the way to Washington, so that was good. But as we drive up, and I think this is important because this gets into the mindset of the president, you know, obviously another key player in this drama, is as we're winding through the special terminal, the media, they're jumping out from behind cars and trying to capture. And so, you know, if you go back and look at the footage that day, KTLA in Los Angeles, they had the kind of the raw footage where you see the motorcade is snaking around reporters, you know, trying to get to where we were going. And so as we pull up to the airplane, the security detail leader says, sir, we're going to pull right up. We need you to just go rush right on board. And so, you know, they didn't know what was going on. You know, people, spectators, all this stuff.
They were doing their job to be careful, but that's not Comey's style or past practice, is it?
Exactly. Yeah. And so that really bothered me, because I thought, well, he hasn't done anything wrong. Like, this is, you know, why the optics of him rushing onto an airplane? But then also, just as important, is every city that we had gone to, and I think I went to like 100 cities with him, he had always told me to carve out time for him to spend time with the cops who had supported his visit. So the local law enforcement
on the ground wants to say hi and thank you.
Exactly. And they would talk and they would chit chat, and some of them would want pictures. And so he'd do all that. And I thought, well, if he rushed on the airplane, that's going to rob him of this great experience, probably the last time that he'll be able to do this. And so I scratched out a note that I handed to him. I didn't want to, you know, overrule my friend, you know, or engage in a debate with my friend on the security detail. So I just handed Comey a note. I said, you've never forgotten the cops. And he kind of nodded. And so if you look at that video, which is kind of interesting in hindsight, there's one angle where when we get out of the vehicle, the security agents head to the airplane, Comey buttons around the Suburban and goes and talks to the cop. The reason I tell that story is because I later learned that the president was watching that moment as well, and that infuriated him. Just this nonchalance, you know, Comey seemingly not...
He didn't have his tail between his legs.
Right.
He was not cowering in fear.
He wasn't cowering. Right. He wasn't shirking away. And so it was at that point that the president apparently told his staff and ordered him that that guy is never allowed back in the FBI space. Mm. And then there was an issue with the airplane, flying the government airplane, and, you know, all this drama that, that ensued. But so once we were wheeled up to Washington, the gravity of the moment really hit.
One other personality I want to get your quick take on, Rod Rosenstein. Rod Rosenstein, there's some irony that you point out in the book, which is that the letter that the president used to fire Comey from the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, in a sense pointed out leadership lapses from Director Comey. This from a man who had just recently invited Director Comey to speak on effective leadership. There's something there that doesn't add up. What's your perspective now with a little bit of hindsight on Rod Rosenstein? On the one hand, protecting the special counsel investigation against what looked like an onslaught from the White House. On the other hand, doing things like that that did not seem to uphold the very principles that he was there to uphold.
So I think in again, I'll preface this by saying, as someone, you know, who's now in journalism, like, none of this is personal. Like, as I look back, obviously these were experiences that that affected those of us who live them on different levels. But I try not to look at it personally. So when I look at someone like Rod Rosenstein, you know, I try not to describe anything personal, but to describe the actions. And then the reader and the listener can judge for themselves what kind of quality a person this is. But in looking at the actions, so again, as you mentioned, you had someone who had invited the FBI director to come talk to his staff in the wake of the Hillary Clinton investigation about what it's like to make tough decisions, to be a good leader. I was there in Maryland for this event. And then fast forward, he then writes this letter essentially giving top cover to the White House to fire Comey because of the Clinton investigation, which made absolutely no sense. The thing that's important about that is that at that point, as it's since been reported, is that before the firing, before that letter was written, Rosenstein and others were meeting with the president, and President Trump wanted Rosenstein to include a part about the Russia investigation in the letter firing Comey. Mm-hmm. And apparently Rosenstein said that's not necessary, but it tells us that Russia was on his mind, and Rosenstein knew it. Yet he did it anyway. And so folks can judge that action. One thing that was a personal experience for me, when I left the Bureau to join CNN, again, my goal was to help the public understand that they were being manipulated. Again, the agency is not perfect, you know, the FBI, but I wanted them to know basically the reason why I wrote this book, that that there are consequences to this campaign of attack. And so when as I was getting ready to leave, I get a call one day from Rod Rosenstein, who I didn't know. I'd met him at this, you know, this event. He didn't know me from Adam. I mean, we were not, you know, in circles, you know, running together. You know, obviously he was the number two at the Justice Department, but he was imploring me not to leave the FBI, not to go to CNN. And he, I mean, it was, you know, he's
with no context, with zero backstory,
zero backstory, but telling me, you are a fantastic special agent. We cannot lose you. And so what I saw this for was someone who didn't want someone who would potentially be a critic of him now going out to in a very public, you know, new position. By the way, he's right. I mean, I have criticized his actions, so maybe he was onto something. But what was so telling about that was not only that whole experience, but I actually told him on the phone, I said, look, the reason why I'm leaving, and I was respectful. I said, I appreciate your comments about me, even though, you know, as unfounded as they were and kind of icky. But I said, look, I'm going to do what you all should be doing at the Justice Department, and that's speaking out to call out these attacks. And rather than saying, yeah, I agree with you, or no, you're wrong, he chose a third way and actually said, and this is so vivid in my mind, which I don't think people, because this didn't come to fruition, I don't think people really appreciate it, but he said, Nunes is moving on from the Justice Department. He's going to attack the deep state and the State Department. So we're out of the woods, essentially. Which was almost
a non sequitur.
Correct, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I went back and looked, and there was, I guess, one story where Nunes had said something critical of the State Department at that point. But that was the view of leadership of the Justice Department that, no, there's someone else who's now going to be – it's their time in the barrel.
So we don't have to step up and defend the workforce and the mission because it's not going to be attacked anymore.
Exactly, which, you know, again, if you're dedicated to the truth and the rule of law, as most people in these agencies are, that doesn't really square. And so anyway, so to tie that up in hindsight, you know, in retrospect, looking back, I think there were things during the Mueller investigation that he did well, you know, coming out and, you know, obviously he became a fierce the president became a critic of Rosenstein's because of certain actions. But the one theme that I've seen – And I've heard in talking with former colleagues is whenever Rosenstein did speak up, and Jeff Sessions for that matter, it wasn't because the agency had taken some hit or the institution. It was because personally they had been attacked, which that's not leadership in my view. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be willing to, as I say, to, you know, lose your job, to do your job. And if you allow these attacks on the agency to continue, if you allow this to bake into the national psyche that these organizations are corrupt, and you sit in a position where you can actually step up and say, this is wrong, or Mr. President, you know, the White House, you are wrong and you need to stop. If you fail to do that, that's not leadership.
Right. Let's talk about what got you to that point to close out here. Is you write about the weeks of anger and frustration. You had recently been promoted to field supervisor position, I believe, in the LA field mm-hmm. office. And yet you felt, I have to leave. I want to speak out about this, what you think of as an assault on the FBI's mission and its future. You chose to do that. Thousands of others have not. Other people have said, I'm just putting my head down. I'm going to keep doing my job. Maybe I hope that the president and others don't care about this counterintelligence investigation I'm doing against China, or this counter-narcotics investigation, or this counterterrorism work, because that's more important than me speaking out. How did you manage that equation? Because that's not an easy choice for you, leaving a job you love, but you're also, in a sense, pointing at other people who have chosen not to do that. How do you square that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It's something, obviously, I've thought a lot about. I've been asked a lot since I've left, well, you know, from other people, should we leave as well? And so my view is, you know, no, don't leave these organizations. And I tell them the reason why I did is because I came to that conclusion that my talents to communicate about this organization could best be used stepping outside this organization to explain to the public why they are being lied to and how they are being lied to and the real nature of these institutions. So I made that choice, and it wasn't easy, obviously. But the one thing that I did is I surveyed the landscape, and going back to the conversation about Rosenstein, it occurred to me that no one is standing up to defend these agencies from political attacks. No one in a position of power. So at that point, Director Wray was fairly new, so I don't really fault him as much. He's, you know, fresh on the scene trying to figure out what's going on. But you had the attorney generals. You certainly had the deputy attorney general. You had members of Congress who, even those who knew these organizations, who had, you know, been on these oversight committees for years, knew the heart and soul of these organizations, were silent. And so I'm looking at that landscape, realizing that on the inside, there's this building anger within our agency. Who's going to defend us? And when I say defend, I think it's important to point out, again, this is kind of the journalist now in me, it's not to defend writ large what these agencies are doing, because again, they have to be held to account, but to defend them from political attacks, which have these consequences. So I just came to that realization that I could best serve not only the agency, but the American people by stepping out and saying, this is reality. And this is, you know, the difference between that and politics. And so that's what I decided to do. It wasn't easy, because giving up a job like that, which was very secure, you know, both financially and just, you know, from a career perspective, was not easy. But what I didn't want to do was look back 15 years later on, you know, retirement and say, well, you could have stepped out to help inform the public, but you decided to stay quiet to get a pension someday. You know, I fault no one who stays in. In fact, I tell them, stay in. We need you. If everyone left, then, you know, that would be terrible. But sometimes, you know, you have to make these tough decisions, and I'm not a victim. I'm not asking anyone to, you know, to think that at all. And I actually find what I'm doing now very rewarding. You know, I wear two hats. I do analysis. I do reporting as well on primary law enforcement, national security issues. So even beyond this, whenever we get past whatever this is, I'll still find that rewarding, knowing that, you know, your listeners, our viewers on TV, and readers of books get to learn, at least from experience, how these organizations operate. The good, the bad, the ugly.
Josh, thanks for sharing your recollections, your reflections with the Lawfare Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Josh Campbell for coming on the show. Please share the podcast, rate the podcast, talk about the podcast. Let people know if you enjoy the Lawfare Podcast, that you do, and why you do. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Michaela Fogel is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.